friends, comrades. Lovely to see some familiar faces and unfamiliar ones. I've been so worried these last few nights, haven't you? You've been really, really worried. I mean, I've just been lying awake at night, just wondering whether Blair took us to war in good faith or not. I have been in a right old state. I really have. I just couldn't wait. And then the Butler report came out and it said, it's okay, he did it in good faith. What the fuck does that mean? In good faith? Do you know, I really have no idea what that means. Does that mean that you were happy about it? Or that you believed in doing it? I don't know. I mean, did Hitler invade Sudetenland in good faith? I think he did. Invaded Poland? Probably the Holocaust he did that in good faith, didn't he? No, I think he did. He was full of good faith. They all are, aren't they? They're all full. They're all honourable men, as Shakespeare said. Yes, that's right. Anyway, I'm now in the clear. I can sleep all right. Is that the same for you? Yeah, good. Yeah, no, I just wanted to clear that up, that's all. I've just been so worried. Anyway, there you go. All right, well, look, I tell you what. I thought I'd begin today with just a little sermon. I would have thought most of you liked sermons. And the sermon really is about how to make Shakespeare unpolitical and safe. Now, it's quite an achievement, really, considering that he was so political and unsafe. But somehow or other, they've managed to do it. So I thought just a little sermon, just to help all those people who do it. So I think the first thing for Shakespeare is that you have to say that he's national and royal. That's a tremendous help to make him unpolitical and safe. So, or apolitical, is it? I don't know. Anyway, national and royal, and that he represents all that's fine about England. That's very important as well. And the second thing you should do is you should prevent, hinder and underfund local and touring theatre companies from bringing the plays to where people live and work and study. I think that's very, very important. So you had the English Shakespeare Company that used to go into schools and factories. What was the guy's name? Bogdanovich. And he went round. I remember seeing them working with a group of kids in a school, and it was great. They stopped funding him. That was very important, I thought that was. The next thing is you force teachers to make the study of Shakespeare the means by which people succeed or fail. That's ever so important, so that you study Shakespeare, and while you're doing it, you're thinking, blimey, if I don't get this right, I'm screwed. Okay? So that's terribly important. Now, you don't have to worry so much about Shakespeare, but just whether you're going to actually get through your GCSEs or your A-levels or whatever else. So you make it the means by which we segregate ourselves. So that's very important. We should also force teachers to make the study of Shakespeare a matter of sitting down. It seems rather extraordinary that, you know, here was this bloke who sat and wrote a set of scripts, and I suppose the only bit of sitting down they did was maybe when they first read the scripts. I don't know, maybe they learnt them orally, we don't actually know, but, you know. And that the consequence, well, how many centuries later it is, 4 centuries later, is that the way we do Shakespeare is sitting down. I mean, in my day it used to be sitting down in rows. They've improved, because now it's sitting down round tables. So that's good. Then another thing we should do is really force teachers to make the study of Shakespeare a great deal about working out what the language means. So ideally you should spend most of the time just saying, well, what does the next word mean? Okay, and then when you've done that word, move on to the next one. That's really good, okay? And then every now and then stop and just explain that the language is brilliant. So what you've got to do, you just say, the language is brilliant, now on to the next word, okay? Then you should also encourage teachers to break the play down into elements, into bits. And the bits are called things like character, plot, imagery. Okay, and then you explore each one of these in turn, and you make a little table and you fill it in, all right? See, I don't think he did that. I don't think Shakespeare did that. Or maybe, did you think he did Hamlet, character? Does it develop? No, I don't know, probably not. You should also avoid talking the characters in the plays. You must avoid this at all counts, okay, on all counts. Avoid talking the characters in the plays as if they're members of any kind of social class or not. Okay, they're just people. So if you have someone like Coriolanus, alright, he's just a person. He just loses his rag occasionally, you know, and yells at people. They happen to be the masses or the plebs or something, but he's not really kind of a member of the ruling class. You don't talk about that, okay? Don't mention that. Claudius in Hamlet, don't talk about him. Talk about him as the king, but never sort of give the idea that somehow he's a member of a class. He's just the bloke with the crown. Okay, that's very important. Also, you should avoid talking to characters as if they represent outlooks. They are just characters. They don't have an opinion. They're not positions in a debate or anything. They're just characters, people. Okay, they don't have an outlook, so there's no debate going on. That's very important. You should also talk in huge generalities at all times, okay? And abstracts. You talk about things like ambition, right, and jealousy, evil, and love. They're very good. And you should talk about these as if somehow those emotions don't actually belong to people. They just kind of hover. So look, there's a bit of ambition just going across the back there. It just hovers around, and then there's some good ambition and there's bad ambition and things like that. And you must never talk about it as if somehow the kind of ambition or jealousy depends on the kind of person saying it, or that it depends on the kind of, heaven forbid, the kind of social class that the person might belong to. So the ambition of someone who wants to be king might be different from the ambition of someone who just wants to get off with someone. It's just ambition. They're like that. Can you try that? 1, 2, 3. Ambition. That's good. You're not great performers, are you? Never mind. That's all right. Okay. I'm not going to get you to stand. That's all right. That's all right. You should also talk about the plays as if they're gods. That's very important. They're gods to be worshipped and adored. And also that they're universal. That's a very important word. You have to keep repeating that. The plays are universal. This means you have to ignore the fact that the plays themselves were ignored for at least 300 years. Okay, but they are just universal. They appeal to everyone, everywhere. Whatever happens, they're just amazing and universal. That's very important. Keep repeating that. And then you should also ignore the fact they come out of any particular place or time. They've just floated into something called the culture or literature. They just came in and they're there now. See them? There they are. That's it. It's good. I've got one in my bag. I'll get it out in a minute and float it, all right? It's called Coriolanus. And you should also never suggest that it came out of a particular, very particular moment in the history of entertainment, in the history of showbiz. You know, you must never ever suggest that, you know, there was something that came before it, something that came after it. It's very, very particular. That you must never suggest that. And also, you must really make no effort to show that the kinds of furious debates that go on in the plays, and that this has anything at all to do with the kinds of debates, pamphlet wars and huge social upheavals, massive ruling class oppression, state-sanctioned terror and wars that were going on at the same time as the plays are written. Don't mention that. Okay? So if you say war, you just say war. I've just read the introduction of Coriolanus. The introduction to Coriolanus in the Arden edition, which, heaven forbid, I've actually recommended for people to look at in that book. But anyway, it doesn't actually mention that there were any tyrants about in Elizabethan times, and doesn't actually mention there were any revolts of any kind, and that all the talk about whether you should actually give the plebs a vote or not, that this possibly might have been a conversation that might have been going on a few inches away from Shakespeare's ear roll. No way, it's never mentioned at all. It's just maybe something to do with Rome and something to do with the universe again. And also, you must absolutely avoid making analogies with the political and social conflicts going on around today. So, you know, let's say Angelo, when he tries to get off with Isabella, and when Isabella says, well, look, I'm going to blow this. If you, Angelo's has come in as a ruling figure in this strange kingdom, and he tries to get off with a nun, some of you remember, and he starts saying how, you know, he quite fancies her, and she says, well, look, you know, I'll tell. And he says, yeah, but who would believe you? And you know, Geoffrey Archer said exactly the same thing. But don't mention that, okay? You don't mention that sort of thing. Who would believe you? Okay, so there we are. That's where I begin with my little sermon, How to Make Shakespeare Unpolitical and Safe. So there's something to work on, folks. In the meantime, I have written something that I hope does just the opposite. And I wanted to read little bits from it. Bear with me, some of you who've heard my Shakespeare kind of riff before, if it overlaps a bit, but you know, I've only got one brain and it does get tired. So this book, could I just give me a little tribute, have a little round. You see the guy on the front row, some of you know him, his name's Huddle, alright, because he's always in a... Anyway, there he is. So could we just have a little round of applause for Roger for the most incredible bit of design. Okay, yes, Roger Huddle, wonderful guy. Fantastic. My missus picked it up and she said, blimey, you ought to take that down to Penguin and show them. Turn your mobiles off, guys. Okay, so here we are. We're sitting in a theatre and an old man, an aristocrat, steps forward and says, in some state of distress, this is what he says, these late eclipses of the sun and moon portend no good to us. Love cools, friendship falls off, brothers divide, in cities, mutinies, in countries, discords, palaces, treason. The bond cracked between son and father, the noble and true-hearted Kent banished. His offence, honesty. 'Tis strange. So this is Gloucester, okay, in King Lear. He turns and goes, and he leaves his bastard son Edmund to step forward. Now, we already know something of Edmund. He's plotting to get his father Gloucester to give him the ancestral land by disowning the legitimate son. So the bastard wants the land that's due to the legitimate son. So he wants to get his hands on it. So he steps forward. All right, Gloucester's gone, and now we've just got Edmund on the stage, and he's talking to us, and he says, he's turning back to what Gloucester's just said. He says, this is the excellent foppery of the world, foolishness, that when we are sick in fortune, often the surfeit of our own behaviour, the excess of our own behaviour, we make guilty of our disasters, the sun, the moon, and the stars, as if we were villains by necessity, fools by heavenly compulsion, knaves, thieves, and treacherous by spherical predominance, drunkards, liars, and adulterers by an enforced obedience of planetary influence, and all that we're evil in by a divine thrusting on. Ha! An admirable evasion of whoremaster man to lay his goatish disposition to the charge of stars. Goatish, basically sexy. My father compounded, had sex with my mother under the dragon's tail, and my nativity was under Ursa Major, so that it follows that I am rough and lecherous. But I should have been that I am had the maidenliest star of the firmament twinkled on my bastardy. So we're thrown into the middle of an intense struggle. At one level, it's a battle for property, old aristocratic land. And at another, it's a struggle of ideas. The Father Gloucester, what's he seen? He's seen a changing world, a breakup of the established order at every level in society. Personal, in matters of love, or between, say, father and son, but also political, he mentions mutinies, treason, and also ideological, he mentions discord. The ultimate reason for this, he thinks, is the stars. No analogies to be made with astrologers now. The bastard son Edmund doesn't deny the description. After all, we know that he's the immediate cause of the discord and mutiny. But he debunks the cause and grabs us with what is, in effect, a materialist, atheist view of destiny. He tells us that he would have been what he is, no matter what star was twinkling at his birth. This double punch, the mix of action and ideas, is precisely what makes Shakespeare such powerful stuff. We find ourselves in the midst of conflicts and confrontations. We're drawn into plotting and scheming carried out by people with ideas and opinions about other people's ideas. So Edmund is immediately commenting on Gloucester, who we've just seen, and they were both talking to us. They don't mutter them to each other. They step forward and berate us with them, telling us what they're thinking at that very moment in the midst of all the plotting and scheming. So now let's look how the rest of the scene unfolds. Edgar, the legitimate son, enters, and then Edmund pretends to be just the opposite of what he is, that he believes the stars do govern our lives. He immediately starts dissembling. He delivers a speech that's really a send-up of what his father just said. An authority on the stars is predicted, he's saying. Unnaturalness between the child and the parent, death, dearth, that's starvation, dissolutions of ancient amities, old friendships, divisions in state, menaces and maledictions against kings and nobles, needless diffidences, banishment of friends, dissipation of cohorts, nuptial breaches, and I know not what. So Edmund carries on conning his brother for a while until he's left alone on stage, and once again he steps forward to speak to us directly. So we've had this movement with first one, then the other, commenting on that, and now we've got another movement. He goes, and now we're still back with Edmund. A credulous father. and a brother noble, whose nature is so far from doing harms that he suspects none, on whose foolish honesty my practices ride easy. I see the business. Let me, if not by birth, have lands by wit, all with me's meat that I can fashion fit. That last line's a bit difficult. It means anything I can utilise is fine by me. All with me's meat that I can fashion fit. Utterly ruthless bastard. Exactly. So once again, we've got the double punch. In terms of the action, it's the father and brother's foolish honesty that makes them gullible. And he loves gullible people, doesn't he? In terms of the politics, we hear the materialist explanation that he'll get land by wit, not by birth. His own intelligence, cunning, skill, and these alone, not the stars, not aristocratic inheritance, will lead him to have wealth. What's more, he'll employ any means necessary to do this. It's all fine by him. All with me's meat that I can fashion fit. Perhaps it would fit that bloke who's trying to take over Marks and Spencer's. So we have confrontation. We have analysis. No, he followed. He didn't succeed, did he? No, hard luck. Oh, I felt so sorry for him. So we have confrontation. We have analysis. We have politics. And we have ideas. All bubbling along at the same time. So this, then, is what we can expect from a Shakespeare play. And whether we're sitting in a theatre, watching a film, or reading it off the page, I always think we can let our minds handle this in different ways. There's enough going on in the scene, like the one I've just described, to let it run as a struggle over property. That's at one level, that's what it seems to be. There's the bad guy, who's a con man, cynic, getting the upper hand over the old fogey and the young fogey good guys. Now, some might be content in feeling it in some general abstract terms as evil versus good. We've already talked about that. But whatever way we see it at first, it is exciting drama. It's ideas in action. So my argument is that the more closely we look and listen to what's going on, another kind of power, different kind of realism appears. So yes, we are looking at evil and good and con man's son versus honest dad. But specifically, we're looking at precisely, and this is the bit that, you know, just amazes me that the critics don't get. We're looking at precisely the kind of conflict and confrontation that was going on in the society that Shakespeare lived in. An old aristocrat senses that the world is falling apart. A member of the new generation poses an alternative way of going on. You can do as well as the old aristocracy with their inherited wealth if you use your wit. So the old order is shown here as honest but doomed, and the new order is shown as dishonest, ruthless, and greedy for power. Now this is precisely the struggle that dominated the London society of Shakespearean times, and of course the rest of Europe. There are even glimpses of it, if you think about it, in modern times. So if you think, say, Margaret Thatcher's Tory party, you know, you had the old wealth lot, the Harold Macmillan style and Ted Heath One Britain politics, and then you had the new wealth, the Norman Tebbit on your bike type. There's no such thing as society politics. So you had the old style patrician approach and the new brash loads of money approach. So you even have an analogy that still survives until quite recently, perhaps still is. In Shakespeare's time, this was a new and disturbing conflict. Many people in England lived in what were feudal or semi-feudal ways. An aristocratic master had rights over how you worked and where you lived. He could call on you for military service and demand that you appear in church on Sunday and on all holy days. In return, he was supposed to ensure that you didn't die of starvation. And if you had a son or daughter, there was a possibility that you might employ them or rape them. These feudal arrangements were, by 1600, being torn down. So you can hear Edmund describing this while pretending to be sorry about it in that speech to Edgar. You remember he said, "Dissolutions of ancient enmities, divisions in state, menaces and maledictions against king and nobles. Trade, manufacture and banking couldn't be held back by potentially loss-making sentimental relationships." So just as the money men say today, they have to be free to use anything and anyone for their ends. So Edmund says again, all with me's meat that I can fashion fit. So in the London around Shakespeare's theatres, this conflict of new versus old was only too apparent. The first bank and stock exchange had been built. Old aristocrats like the Roman Catholic Howard family, still around, from Norfolk had been thrust aside by newer wealth like the Protestant Cecils. Some called them atheists because they were so Protestant and so vicious. The power at the heart of Tudor and early Stuart England. Shame that atheism got such a bad name at that point. At the heart of many of Shakespeare's plays, this conflict is there for us to see. So if you take The Merchant of Venice, we see a struggle between the old way of making money, small-time usury from Shylock, and the new way, speculating on colonial adventures from Antonio. In Richard II, we see Bolingbroke seizing the crown because he deems the king unfit. So much for the divine right of kings. And we see people throughout the plays acting as what the Elizabethans, what Shakespeare calls Machiavels, that's to say, like Machiavelli, who wrote The Prince, on really a lesson in manipulation. So we see people like Richard III, Iago in Othello, Claudius in Hamlet, Angelo in Measure for Measure, Don John in Much Ado, Cassius and so on. And Edmund, of course, who we've just seen in King Lear. Now, these are all new men. This is the important thing about them. They are new men fighting to get their hands on the power once held by the old order. Now, of course, Shakespeare plays don't all follow this theme. They're full of action and debate about plenty of other things. Romantic love in A Midsummer Night's Dream, or pleasure in Twelfth Night, amongst other things. Specifically political themes about tyranny or power and colonialism, as we know, are teased out in Timon of Athens and The Tempest. But these themes are never a matter of dry discussion. What we get with Shakespeare are the many viewpoints of a society in change. Now that simple sentence, I've tried to grasp really what Shakespeare is about. The many viewpoints of a society in change, because wherever I read, you know, just look at one of those, the Arden introduction to Coriolanus, you'd never know that it was written at a moment when the society was in change. And the plays, we talk about the language, yes, the language is rich and diverse, but it's rich and diverse in order to express that moment of change, difficult, complex moment of change. And the language has varying paces and methods. So we have dialogue, soliloquy, where one person seems to just speak their thoughts. We have poetry, we have prose, we have song, and we have sideways comments to the audience. It's not the business that, you know, we live with proscenium arches, where they ignore us for 2 hours and it's called entertainment. You know, you go to the theatre and they just ignore you for 3 hours. I never understood that. I mean, I know it's great art, but it is quite strange. You sort of sit there and go... That bloke giving the speech to the wardrobe, you know, in the cherry orchard, you know. Why don't you turn round? I always think, just turn round a bit, you know. Say some of it to us, at any rate. And he never does. He always says it to the wardrobe. Have you noticed that? Yeah. You get the characters commenting, as we just heard, on other characters and their actions. All of which, this is what makes it dynamic for an audience, because you have to keep working in the audience. You have to keep reflecting on what we see from different angles. Which one of these buggers has got it right? Is Gloucester a goodie or is Edmund a goodie? He's talking sense, and Gloucester talked sense. But then we saw Edmund saying that, see, we saw him dissembling. So all the time we have to be taking this on board. Yeah? So... it's a dynamic process to sit in the theatre, and that is just as the society Shakespeare lived in was at a moment of dynamic change. The two are part of the same thing. That's one of the, you know, seems to be one of the most difficult things for most critics to grasp. You have the dynamic change of the society, and you have the dynamic experience sitting in the theatre. So when we watch or read Shakespeare, we can let our minds run between feeling the characters as if they're real people. After all, we're not just talking about a debate, question time, or something like that. That we can allow ourselves to feel these are real people. We make analogies with the people we know or know of in our lives. You can never escape from that. You can't ever escape from thinking, as Angelo is saying, that, blimey, you know, I wonder whether that's anything like anybody I know. You're doing that all the time. And you can also let the plays work almost as if I like to think of it as if a kind of wave of history is coming over you. Okay, so I wanted to look, let's just check my time here, I wanted to look at just a couple of plays, ideally. I want to look a little bit at Twelfth Night, because Twelfth Night is one of those plays that can easily get kind of lost in some degree of flummery about the idea that it's just a few old drunken people sort of strolling around and then it all ends all right and some bad jokes in between and a strange bloke singing. And you can sort of miss quite easily something of it. Okay, so Twelfth Night is a play that involves a series of disguises and deceptions. This is crucial to the play, which in turn lead to people making errors over the matter of who any person thinks they're talking to. So, for example, the middle-class but not ennobled twins, Viola and Sebastian, are shipwrecked in this place called Illyria. But each imagines that the other is dead. Now, Viola dresses as a man called Cesario, so that she can gain access to the local aristocrat's mansion, notch above her. But in the complicated misunderstandings later in the play, people think that this Viola Cesario, woman dressed as man, or boy really, Viola Cesario person is her twin brother, Sebastian, and vice versa, that Sebastian is Viola Cesario. The play's humour often relies on the speed with which all these and the other deceptions become intertwined and dangerous. Dangerous for the people concerned. As the clown Feste observes at one point, nothing that is so is so. So this kind of farce, and possibly all farces, work as crazy extensions of real life. If you think about it, in real life we frequently make mistakes of identification, misjudgments of appearance, misnamings and the like. So, for example, parents are renowned for calling their offspring's new lover by the name of his or her ex. Yeah, I know, yeah, tell me about it. There is both humour and danger in these moments, and indeed the ghastly story of gangland rivalries has sometimes involved killing the wrong guy. So getting identities wrong is seen as an everyday mistake. Now, in Elizabethan London, there were plenty of reasons for it to be similarly a matter for laughter and or danger. Marriage among the aristocracy and the aspiring middle classes was still a matter of matching and arranging. A theme that runs right through writing from Elizabethan time onwards, think about it in Jane Austen, centres on the anxiety of the rich and the better off that some impoverished impostor might con his way into marrying into their family. Now, in Shakespeare's time, the anxiety about such matters must have been reaching a level never before experienced. The new rich were desperately trying to become titled, while the impoverished gentry, and there were plenty of them too, were trying to get hold of the wealth of the new rich, while at the same time not giving up their, quote, nobility. Now, for those outside of such ghastly manoeuvrings, you know, we can just feel it as a matter of comedy, perhaps. But the more serious side to the matter of identity in Shakespeare's England was the matter of spying. For some strange reason, you know, I've read quite a lot on Hamlet, and very few people ever mention the fact that the Elizabethan society was basically a terrorised spy society. And so when frequently through the play people are spying on Hamlet, whether it's Polonius or Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, that this might have some resonance with that society as it was. Strange. It was a matter of life and death if you were identified as someone not loyal to the throne or the Church of England or both, or for that matter if you were a thief, a deserter or a mutineer. It's a matter of life or death if you were wrongly identified. Now, of course, it was a society without identity papers, passports and the like, and with plenty of people with scores to settle from previous plots, mutinies, conspiracies and wars, hundreds of them, there must have been hundreds, if not thousands, of cases of deliberately falsified identification leading to wrongful imprisonment, torture and execution. This business of identity and mistaken identity in the kind of society that Shakespeare lived in was absolutely crucial. Twelfth Night and plays like it offer audiences what can be called anxious laughter. It's a vital phrase. Anxious laughter. A laughter born out of a mix of gratitude that it hasn't happened to me. Pleasure at other people's misfortunes. Surprise at the unexpected and delight in the success in showing that other people, apart from yourself, can be conned. Thereby proving that you are at the very least no more foolish than the next person. But the dangerous side of wrong identification is represented in the play. We get the captain of the wrecked ship who will, if found by the authorities, be imprisoned and executed. Anything at all to do with Elizabethan times? I think so. Two, when the knockabout duelling between the ninny knight, Sir Andrew Aguecheek, and the sozzled knight, he's completely pissed all the time, Sir Toby Belch, and Viola Cesario, draws in the very lethal swordsman, Sebastian, the twin brother. So another kind of anxious laughter is also explored in the play with the mourning, dutiful lady of the gentry. She's called Olivia, you remember, and finds that she's fallen hopelessly in love with Viola Cesario. So remember, that's a woman dressed as a boy. Come to how Shakespeare played it in a minute. Meanwhile, the mournful, effete, aristocratic gent, Duke Orsino, he seems to half fancy the same person. So is he fancying a boy? He's fancying a boy dressed as a woman. Anyway, we'll get there. A glorious riff on hetero and same-sex love plays with our own sexual natures, whatever they might be. As is often pointed out, in Shakespeare's time, Viola and Olivia would have been played by boys. So get this, there are times when the boy playing Olivia is speaking passionate words to the boy playing Cesario, who is in reality a boy disguised as a woman disguised as a man. Now tell me that, yeah, no, somebody's going like that, meaning there's more to it than that. Yeah, well, it's all right, you can explain some more, yeah. There's a lot going on, that's all you need to know, and a lot more, and it's a crucial question of identity, and it is about sexual natures of all kinds. Now, there was an enemy to this kind of sexual fun. It came in the form of the reformers within the Protestant tendency of Christianity. Every religion in the history of all religions, as we know, is thrown up at times of crisis and change. It's reformers who want to get back to something that they identify as uncorrupted or pure. In the 16th and 17th century Europe, these reformers gave themselves, or were given many names, including Anabaptist, they were the goodies by the way, Calvinist, Hussite, Puritan, and Brownist, the last two, being named in Twelfth Night, Puritan and Brownist. Now Shakespeare had good reason to hate the Puritans. They were powerful in London government, and did all they could to close down the theatres and any kind of seasonal fun and games or carnival. Of course, if all that the Puritans were was dull killjoys, we'd never have heard of them. But it's to the Puritans and their ilk, and not the pleasure-seeking Catholics, English or Roman, that we owe what democracy we have in Western and Northern Europe, but never mind. In Twelfth Night, the Puritan enemy is Malvolio, who's a steward. That's to say, he's a sort of line manager, housekeeper and bursar for the Countess Olivia's mansion. So she, we might assume, is perhaps of a similar tendency, Puritan and Brownist perhaps, particularly as she's mourning her brother's death so dutifully, dressed in black. Malvolio is loathed by the sponging, decadent, drunken uncle of Olivia, Sir Toby Belch, and Olivia's maidservant Maria, and these two suck in the fool, Feste, and a rich wastrel rural knight, Sir Andrew Aguecheek, and another house servant, Fabian. And they're all drawn in to deceiving and baiting the Puritan, Malvolio. When this deception is acted well, this can be devastatingly funny. Much of it turns on Malvolio's hypocrisy. The very person who despises drunken, licentious behaviour and the pleasures of the body is conned into muttering to himself obscene references to peeing and a woman's fanny as he tries to decipher a false letter. And it's this letter that deceives him into thinking that the Countess Olivia loves him, he who is no more social class crucial than her servant and steward. And the depth of the conflict is represented by the drunken uncle, Sir Toby Belch, when he shouts at Malvolio, "Dost thou think because thou art virtuous there shall be no more cakes and ale?" Now this phrase means exactly what it means, but it also had a massive resonance with its contemporary audience, because cakes and ale was the familiar name for the parties and wild goings on in and around churchyards on festive occasions. The cakes and ale in question were the presents that the old local nobility gave to the peasantry as part of its, quote, protection. It was a custom of the old order and very much opposed by the Puritans because it led to drunkenness, sex and less efficient work practices. Puritan-inclined ministers banned cakes and ale from their churches. So what does the drunk say? The drunken knight says, "Dost thou think because thou art virtuous, there shall be no more cakes and ale?" So though Twelfth Night is a play whose texture and plotting rely on the issues of deception over and over again, the motives for and the outcomes of the deceptions involve other considerations. Now, my view of the play is that it shows us people at different levels in society doing whatever they can to satisfy their appetites. The opening line is spoken by a lovesick aristocrat, Duke Orsino, who, though he sees himself as an expert on love and claims to be in love, does nothing about actually meeting and talking to the woman in question. The line is the famous, "If music be the food of love, play on." His love is then a kind of narcissistic, non-touchy-feely love, full of flowery phrases. It's a love that can't lead to reproduction because it's so cerebral. So if the aristocracy are like this, well, they'll die out. And this is matched at the outset by the Countess Olivia, who can't love because her brother has died. For these two, their route to real pleasure of the body, sex, pleasure, energy and reproduction is cut off. Another side of the layer of the middle class, who when titled with a sir or countess are usually described as the gentry, is seen as a Toby Belch and the unsexual man he's sponging off, Sir Andrew Aguecheek. Belch is utterly intent on getting hold of money so he can spend it on booze, and he's quite happy to con his friend Sir Andrew into giving it to him. Now, though Belch fancies Maria the maidservant, as part of his general grab pleasure quick attitude, his pleasure too is in a cul-de-sac of alcoholic self-destruction. Belch and gang get a good deal of pleasure in the baiting of the seemingly anti-pleasure person Malvolio, but even this runs out of steam and turns sour. And Aguecheek, we see over and over again, is unable to be sexual in any way at all. He misunderstands what it means to accost a woman and wistfully looks back to a time when he was adored once. His supposed wooing of Olivia is a mere shell and is only continuing because Belch is deceiving him that Olivia is interested in him. Meanwhile, the lower middle class Malvolio is repression personified, for both in secret and when unlocked, it's clear that he fancies both Olivia and Maria, but himself most of all. And the exciting and in the end most fulfilling pursuits of pleasure come from the two main women. Olivia, when her sexual energies are aroused by Viola Cesario, who is, as she perceives him, is a boy, it's him, and Viola, who fancies the pants of Duke Orsino. For most of the play, the route to satisfying these pleasures is blocked off. Olivia is in love with someone who is in reality a woman, and Viola can't declare a love for Orsino because she's pretending to be his manservant. This gives Shakespeare a great opportunity to show us Viola nearly revealing her womanhood, either to stem the flow of Olivia's passion towards her or because she wants to say to Orsino that she's hot for him. For much of the play, this pent-up sex desperately needs to be satisfied. But all is saved by Olivia's twin brother Sebastian, so enabling Olivia to grab him lustfully and for Viola to whip off her disguise and have Orsino after all. Now, if such fun leads somewhere other than the sheer pleasure of the moment in watching it, surely in the direction of how Shakespeare possibly imagined that the old aristocracy and the gentry class just below it could keep or revive its energy. Now, this is a theme that runs through history, through British history. Can the aristocracy survive? If so, how? Do they make alliances with the banking classes? Do they make alliances with the energetic capitalist classes coming up? How can they survive? We see it played out on these kind of strange, wistful programs on the telly when we see some old aristocrat walking through his pile, moaning that he hasn't got enough money. Now, it won't happen by behaving like Orsino, with effete non-reproductive sex, nor like Olivia at the outset, weighed down with dutiful celibacy, nor like Belch and Aguecheek getting pissed and getting a rise out of baiting the new Puritan lower middle class and sponging off each other. Reviving and sustaining their position, the aristocrat position, might come about, the play suggests to me, by releasing the sexual energies of middle-class women. Now, it's not something we necessarily have to agree with in some ideological way, but to watch the machinations and arguments reveals the moment of change in society. The status quo at the opening of the play would, if allowed to continue, lead to sterility and decay. So that's where we begin. Now, the arrival of the untitled, i.e. middle-class Viola on the scene, sets everything in motion. The very motion of the classes in Shakespeare's society. Her arrival in what used to be called society, i.e. upper middle-class life, is underlined by the fact she arrives from a shipwreck with virtually nothing. So what I'm arguing here is that this is, in a way, a symbol of the way the new middling sort, as they were called, the new upper middle classes, symbol of the way they appeared, as if they'd arrived with next to nothing into London's, quotes, society. Viola marries up to the level of a duke. Meanwhile, the potency of these new people is represented by the fact that middle-class Sebastian, Viola's brother, actually defeats the decaying gentryman Sir Toby Belch in a sword fight before winning the gentrywoman Olivia from the lair in society above his. Now, when we read Twelfth Night, when we read the great volumes of criticism about it, this movement of classes that actually takes place before our eyes, with all the background of the dangerous laughter, the anxious laughter around the issue of deception, seemed to me absolutely tied in to where Elizabethan society was. And we can relate it very easily to things that go on in our society too. Now, my time's up. I've just read a couple of bits from this book that I've done for Bookmarks. And let's have a discussion, open it to you. Please join in.